Peterson. I'm a nurse practitioner with psychiatry. I work out of the empath unit as well as emergency psychiatry. The topic today is substance use disorder in pregnancy and lactation. At the end of the presentation, I'd like you to understand the potential risks associated with cannabis use during pregnancy and lactation, potential risk of methamphetamine use during pregnancy and lactation, as well as potential risk of benzodiazepine use during pregnancy and lactation. I do not have any disclosures. We may be talking about off-label use. FDA drugs in psychiatry is somewhat common. We'll start out with a little case study. So you have a 34-year-old female who is currently 16 weeks pregnant with a history of alcohol use disorder, severe in remission, who presents to your OBGY outpatient appointment. During the appointment, she reveals she had a recent breakup with a boyfriend 1 week ago, reports after 3 years of sobriety, she relapsed on alcohol. She admits to drinking 2 glasses of wine a day for the last week and wants some help with this. She does report she has a history of alcohol withdrawal, including alcohol withdrawal seizures. During your appointment, you check LFTs, CBC with differential, PTINR, and ethanol. Laboratory work is unremarkable. LFTs were within normal limits. CBC did not show any thrombocytopenia. PTINR were all normal. Unfortunately, her ethanol level comes back at a 0.4, which is somewhat shocking as she was clinically sober during your appointment. We'll get back to the case study at the end of the presentation. I just want you to kind of think about it, what you would do while we talk about the other topics. So, substance use disorder has a neurobiological basis. No one chooses this disease. It's a chronic illness, same as diabetes. You have a choice of whether you take your insulin, whether you don't take your insulin, what food choices you make. So your choice lies in how you manage your chronic illness. Hypertension and asthma actually have higher rates of relapses than people with substance use disorder, yet they don't carry that same guilt, shame, or emotional reactivity that response can happen in healthcare providers. Be aware, shame or fear may be preventing the mother from revealing use, especially shame over or fear of CPS. Some data on prevalence: about 1 in 10 pregnant women report using substance use disorder substances, including cannabis, nicotine, stimulants, alcohol, illicit opiates, within the last month. Nicotine and cannabis were the most common reported. You want to be aware, surveys likely underrepresent substance use prevalence. Findings of 6% of pregnant women report illicit substance use, 8.5% report alcohol use. In the US, 4% of pregnant women report binge drinking in the last month. Given the fear of CPS, patients are reluctant to divulge their use with providers. I would recommend any provider to be aware of substance use and pregnancy reporting laws in your current state that you practice. Don't ever hesitate to ask someone about their substance use. Come at that conversation with an open mind, non-judgmental. ACOG's position is providers should openly discuss substance use with all patients in prenatal care and avoid punitive reporting laws to improve birth outcomes. I like to start with praising the patient for seeking prenatal care, engaging them in non-threatening assessments. I often start with their smoking history and then, move up from there: alcohol, cannabis, methamphetamines, opiates. So some screening tool that CentraCare uses is 5 P's. It includes assessment on did your parents have problems with alcohol or drug use? The next question goes through, does your partner have problems with alcohol or drug use? Before you were pregnant, did you have problems with alcohol or drug use? And then you jump into the last month, did you drink beer, wine, or liquor or other drugs? So when I do screening tools, I just remember this is a screening tool. Often patients might be quickly going through this. Sometimes they can be dishonest on a screener and tell you face to face something totally different. So remembering after the screener, you want to have that conversation still with the patient. Any positive in the screener, you talk about brief interventions to inform the woman's of potential harm of drug abuse to the mother and fetus, referral to treatment, consistent communication and collaboration with the treatment providers you send them to, and planning for a safe environment in that postnatal period. So after you give birth, if you relapse, if you use, who's taking care of the child, who are your supports? So, routine urine drug screens are not recommended. You use them when they're clinically indicated, such as new onset of seizures. Consent is required before conducting toxicology tests. Be aware of false positives and utilize confirmatory tests. Sorry. Amphetamines have up to 14% false positive, opioids up to 34%. Even when you use the confirmatory tests, they're not 100% accurate. They should be, but Department of Justice investigated one company in Michigan, found 30% of the drug tests results were actually inaccurate, and these results were provided to child welfare protection. The machines were not calibrated, unfortunately. A positive drug scene, a screen in its own does not equate to a use disorder. This is a screening and requires further intervention, investigation, asking about pattern of use, tolerance, craving. How is their use impacting relationship, health, socioeconomics? Are they going to work? Are they spending all day thinking about use or trying to find that drug or substance? Are they having consequences of their use? And if they're having consequences, are they continuing to using despite those consequences? So again, you're referencing your DSM-5 for making the diagnosis of a substance use disorder. Being aware of false positives, amphetamines, buprenorphine can cause a false positive, labetalol, methylphenidate, rantidine, trazodone, among others, benzodiazepines, sertraline, cannabis, NSAIDs, and PPIs can cause false positives. Cocaine, it should be just cocaine. Fentanyl, false positives, trazodone, ziprasidone, Invega, risperidone, labetalol. Opioids also has poppy seeds, Benadryl, quetiapine, verapamil, among others. All guidelines recommend appropriate counseling and screening for women regarding alcohol, smoking, and drug use during the antenatal period. You want to test for STIs. Your early identification leads to prompt intervention and more favorable outcomes. Substance use in pregnancy increases the risk of not completing antenatal care, developing worsening mental health, relationships, socioeconomic issues, increased risk of high-risk sexual behaviors, separation from the child. Treatment of substance use disorder during pregnancy is similar to the treatment of substance use disorder in non-pregnant patients, except you're really going to emphasize on multidisciplinary approach. your OBGYN should be communicating with addiction medicine, should be communicating with psychiatry. We all need to talk for the best of the patient. Alcohol and opiate withdrawal cause fetal demise. So medical admissions for treatment of alcohol and opiate withdrawal are justified for fetal monitoring, where maybe if they weren't pregnant, you might be able to monitor them safely in an outpatient setting. It's unlikely to happen in during pregnancy. You're probably going to have to admit them to the medical floor. Opiate overdoses are the leading cause of death in the prenatal period, more than hemorrhage or obstetrical complications. Both methamphetamine and opiate use were associated with poor maternal mental health, higher rates of trauma, and poverty, misuse of heroin, and synthetic opiates such as fentanyl have increased mortality in your pregnant and postpartum women. Fentanyl use in pregnant women was approximately 1%. Again, fentanyl is highly toxic, deadly, awful drug. Pregnancy-associated deaths from 2017 to 2020, about 1,249 were overdose-related out of the 7,642. It's common to have co-occurring psychiatric illness with opiate use disorders, including depression, anxiety, PTSD, mood disorders. Maternal complications with opiate use in pregnancy with IV drug use include malnutrition, bloodborne pathogens, skin abscesses, endocarditis, preeclampsia, premature rupture of the membranes, toxemia, breech position, fetal complications from perinatal opiate use include preterm birth, intrauterine growth restriction, fetal death, and signs of neonatal abstinence syndrome. Advantages of methadone or buprenorphine: reduces illicit drug use, their associated consequences, as well as the accidental overdoses and death. Both methadone and buprenorphine can safely be used during pregnancy and are obviously way safer than untreated opiate use disorder. So there's a study with opiate medical detoxification. So you detox someone instead of using long-term maintenance with Suboxone or methadone. That is not recommended. So if you just detox the woman, they are at high risk of relapse. During the detox period, you just want to be aware too, when you're switching from, you're getting them off their illicit opiates to starting Suboxone or methadone long-term, you want to be aware that fetal distress can occur, and there is a risk of spontaneous abortion. So fetal monitoring is recommended. Both buprenorphine and methadone during lactation are safe and can help aid in the symptoms of neonatal abstinence syndrome. There's some studies saying that buprenorphine resulted in fewer fetal movement abnormalities and less severe neonatal abstinence syndrome compared to methadone. Either treatment can be justified. Buprenorphine is easier to access, less restrictive, but methadone is also safe. Little information on neonatal abstinence syndrome, which is something that can occur when a woman is taking Suboxone or methadone. It's a term to refer to infant withdrawal multiple substances. It's classically used with opiate withdrawal symptoms. Symptoms can occur 3 days after birth, but it may occur later as well. Can take days to a couple weeks to recover. Symptoms usually tremor, hypertonia, fussiness, fever, yawning, diarrhea, nausea, and congestion. It's difficult to predict which infant will develop NAS. How much is the mother using? How much is the infant's metabolism? If there is polydrug use, that increases the risk of NAS. There is a risk of sudden infant death syndrome, seizures, jaundice, and low birth weight with these infants. They may require additional nutritional support, specialized nursing care, recommend breastfeeding and rooming in to help reduce these risks. Again, the standard of care with opiate use disorder is medication-assisted treatment, either with Suboxone or methadone. Lactation, breastfeeding is safe with both your Suboxone and methadone, should be continued to reduce the neonatal withdrawal symptoms. Relative infant dose, American Pediatric Society recommends under 10% should be safe, although you still monitor the infant for changes in behavior. Sedation is the main one. Methadone, relative infant dose is 9% or less. Buprenorphine, relative infant dose is minuscule, 0.63% or less. Buprenorphine is present in the breast milk and the plasma at low levels. Naloxone was not detected or detected at very low concentrations. Naloxone is unlikely to have systemic effects when given sublingually because the oral bioavailability is quite low, less than 10%. It's really meant to prevent diversion when someone is injecting, if they try to inject Suboxone. Fentanyl is present in the breast milk. It accumulates in breast milk. It can persist at toxic levels 24 hours after last use. Fentanyl or norfentanyl can be detectable at trace levels for 5 days. So the recommendations for breastfeeding is resuming 48 hours to 5 days after last use with some supervision, lots of monitoring, or after negative UDS. And being aware, our regular UDS screens do not show fentanyl. You have to actually order a fentanyl urine test. Cannabis use during pregnancy, they're often daily users. Clinicians should discuss cannabis use and pregnancy the same as we discuss your tobacco and alcohol use. Research has shown that providers are not consistently counseling the risks associated with cannabis use in pregnancy and lactation. And just being aware that in the community, these CBD cannabis stores are telling pregnant women that it's good for their nausea and maybe promoting it as safe. The data is limited on cannabis use in pregnancy, mostly because there's a lot of polysubstance use in the studies, retrospective or observational studies, lack of drug testing, small sample size, no consistent dosing. So there's many different forms of cannabis and different ways to use it. So vaping, dabbing, or ingesting. All of these have different potencies and onsets of action. Smoking and vaping has the quickest onset, 1 to 3 minutes, can duration of 1 to 3 hours. Dabbing's very concentrated, same onset and duration as smoking. Oral absorption is onset of 30 to 90 minutes, duration of 6 to 8 hours. American Academy of Pediatrics, ACOG, CDC all recommend against cannabis use during pregnancy. There is a lack of definite safety information and data regarding potential adverse effects on fetal and child development. Cannabis use and pregnancy is discouraged due to insufficient evidence regarding potential risk of exposure during lactation. Cannabis use in pregnancy is more prevalent in younger individuals, HIV, opiate or and cocaine users, lower socioeconomic classes. Although really this can affect anyone. It's very common. Depression, anxiety, and trauma are all associated with pregnant cannabis users. Heavy cannabis users can experience withdrawal symptoms starting 24 to 40 hours after last use, usually peaks within 2 to 6 days. Symptoms include irritability, insomnia, anxiety, depressed mood, loss of appetite. Women who use cannabis during pregnancy had higher rates of anemia. Cannabis use and pregnancy was associated with small for gestational age, preterm birth, and low birth weight, but there is co-founding factors of tobacco use. Cannabis use was also associated with fetal developmental concerns, increased risk of neurodevelopmental disorders. THC exposed pregnancies had decreased placental perfusion and showed evidence of microinfarctions. Withdrawal-like symptoms in the newborns that mimic NAS include tremors, increased startle reflex. As early as 18 months, you can see increased aggressive behaviors and attention deficits in the child. Longitudinal prospective studies effects on prenatal cannabis use associated with neural, developmental, and behavioral outcomes. It's small sample size, but there's been found to have lower child performance, deficits in short-term memory, lower verbal scores. By 10 to 14, there's increase of ADHD and delinquency, as well as affective symptoms. There's an association with autism spectrum disorder. The literature does not consistently support association with fetal malformation and cannabis use in pregnancy. There was secondhand exposure for an infant to cannabis smoke was associated with SIDS. So talking to a woman's partner as well to abstain from smoking, not sharing the bed with the infant if using. Cannabis is found in the breast milk. Single feeding can be 0.8%, 2.5% of the maternal dose in 4 hours after last use. Highest concentration after an hour, but it decreases after 8 hours. You're not really recommended pumping and dumping because THC was measurable 6 days after maternal use. There may be a decrease in breast milk due to the effect on prolactin. Cannabis use and breastfeeding was associated with decreased motor development at the age of one. However, they also had perinatal exposure to THC, and other studies did not consistently show this risk. The studies with the cannabis use and lactation, often the mother was using during pregnancy, so it's hard to tell the effect what cannabis has during lactation versus pregnancy. Methamphetamine use in pregnancy. Methamphetamine is highly addictive psychostimulant, very common in Minnesota. It can affect anyone of all backgrounds. Animal studies show that methamphetamines cross the placenta within 30 seconds of IV administration. Contaminants in methamphetamine include fentanyl. Women are vulnerable for STDIs, sexual violence, unintended pregnancy, housing instability, sexual exploitation, and mental health decompensation. Syphilis transmission is high among methamphetamine users. Vasoconstriction, so obviously it has cardiovascular effects such as arrhythmia, dilated cardiomyopathy. Reasons for using stimulants, depend on the patient, could include coping with stress, appetite suppression, untreated ADHD. There are fewer overdoses among people with methamphetamine. However, than your opiate users. However, long-term socioeconomic consequences are great. The effects of the mother and the fetus from methamphetamine abuse are worse than prescribed amphetamines due to these are they're going way above than anything you would prescribe. It's 100 times more. It's not regulated. It's a bunch of contaminants in it. Polysubstance use and or potential substance contamination, maternal malnutrition, and adverse social circumstances. Exploring the effects of methamphetamine use during pregnancy have been limited due to small sample size, confounding variables, such as other substance use. Amphetamines are one of the most common illicit drug use, along with cannabis. The high can last 8 to 24 hours, half-life 8 to 13 hours versus 1 to 3 hours for your cocaine users. You can see acute hypertension, hyperthermia, stroke, arrhythmia, tremors, neurotoxic paranoia, and hallucinations. In pregnant women, amphetamine use can result in fetal hypoxia secondary to reduced placental perfusion, increased vascular resistance. There are also neurodevelopmental effects following 5 years. Found methamphetamine exposed children had increased emotional reactivity, anxiety, depression, ADHD, and aggressive behaviors. Transient effects on gross motor development, no effect on the language and cognition, modest effects on the behavior and executive function, which also may be related to early adversity, including CPS, socioeconomic foster care. Neonatal complications of methamphetamine use during pregnancy include preterm birth, low birth weight, your small babies, miscarriages, and medical termination have been reported 33 to 41% of pregnant methamphetamine use. Animal studies show a reduction in uterine and umbilical blood flow following maternal methamphetamine administration. Prenatal exposure to methamphetamine increases the risk of neonatal death. Complications during pregnancy associated with methamphetamine use include so fetal growth restriction, basal spasms, heart failure, pulmonary hypertension, hypertensive crisis, preeclampsia, placental hemorrhage, abruptions, maternal morbidity is 2.9% with methamphetamine use. Opiate use was 2.4%. Other substances, 1.6%. Women with continued use of methamphetamine during pregnancy should obviously be offered substance use treatment, serial ultrasounds to assess fetal growth, monitored for neurodevelopmental risk. They found with prenatal methamphetamine exposure, there was reduced subcortical volumes in the neonate. Social disadvantages can further increase the risk of neurodevelopmental outcomes, such as foster care placement. Children who were removed from maternal custody at birth had lower IQs than children discharged to maternal custody. Maternal child services in the home to support to keep families together is important. Again, your methamphetamine users, we want a multidisciplinary team approach. Women who stop using methamphetamine during pregnancy have improved birth outcomes. Babies may struggle with feeding, lower arousal, sleep, and muscle tone abnormalities if methamphetamine is used throughout the pregnancy. The symptoms are usually transient and don't require any medical interventions. There's a high rate of NICU admissions for the methamphetamine exposed infant, poor sucking, difficulties with breastfeeding. Really, the binge episodes of methamphetamine are not conducive to breastfeeding. they can last 2 weeks where people aren't sleeping and then they're crashing for a week and non-functional. There's no literature regarding withdrawal management of or treatment of withdrawal for women who are pregnant with methamphetamine. The withdrawal symptoms are usually fatigue, dysphoria, cravings that can last a couple of weeks. Amphetamine use can inhibit prolactin release, can reduce the breast milk supply. The concentration of amphetamines found in breast milk was 2.8 to 7.5 times higher than those found in maternal plasma. Infants who ingest the breast milk of women who use amphetamines exhibit increased irritability, agitation, and crying. Amphetamines purchased illegally often contain a mixture of substances with unpredictable harmful effects on the woman and her infant. Therefore, women who are actively using methamphetamines really should not breastfeed. It takes an average of 72 hours for methamphetamine to be undetectable in the breast milk. So harm reduction would be recommending to withhold breastfeeding for 100 hours after last methamphetamine use. Also being aware that there's likely fentanyl in the methamphetamine, or 24 hours after negative UDS. Benzodiazepine use in pregnancy. So anxiety disorders are quite common in pregnancy. Up to 15% can increase each trimester. Benzodiazepines were found to be the third most frequent used psychotropic. Approximately 3.9% are prescribed benzodiazepines during pregnancy. 1.7 to 1.9% of women are prescribed in the first trimester. They readily cross the placental barrier. Most patients do not misuse prescription drugs. However, if they do, it's common that they're hiding their use, going to multiple providers, buying it online. Concurrent use of benzodiazepines and opiate increases the overdose risk because of the potentiating effects. Misuse of Xanax. Misuse frequency is higher with your rapid onset because that equates higher rewards. So Xanax gets into the system quickly, leaves the system quickly. Valium, clonazepam, Ativan. Benzodiazepine use during the first trimester generally not been linked to congenital malformations. Some studies linked use during pregnancy with preterm delivery and low birth weight. However, it's unclear if it's association to the medication versus the condition they are being used to treat. Exposure near delivery can be associated with withdrawal or toxicity in the neonate, especially if the high-dose benzodiazepines were used. Neonates may need additional monitoring and support. One study showed that there was associated risk of miscarriage. However, the increase was not higher than baseline risk of miscarriage. The sudden discontinuation of benzodiazepines or Z-hypnotics may lead to extreme withdrawal and relapse of illness during pregnancy, so slow tapers are recommended, more than 2 weeks. Spontaneous abortion can occur with benzodiazepine use. They found benzodiazepine-exposed pregnancy had increased risk of 50% of spontaneous abortion. However, that was compared to people receiving benzodiazepines versus non-benzodiazepines. It did not raise against the general risk of 12 to 15% of all pregnancy risk of miscarriage. And it was hard to eliminate additional factors that could have led to the spontaneous abortions. Benzodiazepine withdrawal can lead to various mental and physical symptoms that can affect fetal development. Withdrawal can be expected for anyone who takes benzodiazepines continuously for 3 to 4 weeks. Symptoms of withdrawal mimic alcohol withdrawal, including CNS excitability, tachycardia, tremors, diaphoresis, anxiety, delirium, and seizure risks. can start 24 hours after last use, peaks within around 1 to 5 days. Valium and clonazepam have longer half-life, so may have longer later onset of withdrawal. You can use tapers scheduled or if inpatient can do symptom-based taper on a CEWA. Outpatient tapers, we usually do 10 to 25% weekly reductions. Can consider transitioning to longer half-life benzodiazepines for tapers such as diazepine or clonazepam. High-dose benzodiazepines require detoxification under close supervision and hospitalization. So breastfeeding, relative infant dose, we want under 10%. Xanax is 9.3% or less. There is 2 cases of sedation, clonazepam 4.6%, 1 case of apnea, 1 case of sedation, lorazepam 4.4%, no adverse effects, zolpidem minuscule, and no adverse effects. Given the consideration of half-life, Valium, Klonopin are longer. So, if breastfeeding, you may want to choose someone with a shorter half-life, such as the lorazepam. Out of 145 infants exposed to benzodiazepines during breastfeeding, 130 had no adverse effects. The adverse effects that were seen are sedation, apnea. So, referral to treatment. I recommend referral to treatment through addiction medicine. They're awesome. They have a great team. They really want to help your patients and get them in quickly. So any pregnant woman with active substance use, I would refer them. They can connect them with a variety of services. They have same day, sometimes next day appointments. In-person appointments are preferred. However, a virtual option is available if there is difficulties with transportation. They don't have e-consults, but if you have someone in the clinic and you feel like they need a conversation right at that moment, you can secure chat the great nurses there through St. Cloud Hospital Addiction Medicine Services nurses. They're available Monday through Friday, 8 to 4. You can also get the patient the nurse line number so they can call on their own, 320-229-3760, extension 2-3735. So, when to refer to the emergency room? Alcohol use in pregnancy, opiate use in pregnancy, because the withdrawal monitoring is going to require hospitalization, especially fetal monitoring. Illicit benzodiazepine use in pregnancy, may want to consider sending to the ER for withdrawal monitoring as well. So, back to our case study. A 34-year-old who's 16 weeks pregnant in your OB clinic with the shocking blood alcohol level of 0.4, who is clinically sober. I would recommend referring this patient to the emergency room for medical admission. Although your labs are stable, your AST, ALT are looking good, platelets are good, her PT and INR all great, there's a high likelihood she's going to withdraw. She's likely underreporting how much she's been using and for how long, as she's clinically sober at a 0.4. She also has a history of bad alcohol withdrawal with the history of seizures, so she's likely to withdraw again. Do you report her to CPS or do you not report her to CPS? That depends. You can report her to CPS. You can also, if she's been following you in with prenatal care, monitor. If she continues to follow up with you with prenatal care, you do not have to report. Now, if she starts no-showing for prenatal appointments and you can't get a hold of her, then I would report. This patient was successfully treated on the medical unit with lorazepam. They used symptom-based CEWA treatment. She was discharged from the hospital. After 4 days, she completed a chemical dependency assessment during her hospitalization. She successfully transitioned to residential treatment. So, best case scenario, Here's some clinical resources on if you want a link to local laws and regulations for your CPS reporting, perinatal harm reduction toolkits, and interesting information, some references. If you guys have any questions, I'd be happy to help out the best I can. My email is here. Thank you so much for your time.